Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Yesterday, Kentucky Senator Rand Paul announced he is running for president, the second Republican formally into the race after Ted Cruz of Texas. A whole lot more announcements expected soon. Jeb Bush, Scott Walker, Marco Rubio, and more. It's a big field of GOP contenders shaping up with a lot of strengths and weaknesses and angles on the campaign, on the American future, on Hillary Clinton. This hour on Point, we're looking at the emerging GOP presidential field. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you see in this emerging lineup? Strengths, weaknesses, winners, losers, ideas? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me today from Washington is Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Karen, great to have you with us today.
Great to be here, Tom.
And from Washington, David Winston joins us, president of the Winston Group, political strategy and polling firm. He's advised a lot of Republicans, including Newt Gingrich in 2012. David Winston, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be back.
Good to have you. And from Des Moines, Iowa, Steve Dace joins us, host of the nationally syndicated Steve Dace Show, author of Rules for Patriots, How Conservatives Can Win Again, contributor to the Washington Times. Steve Dace, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you very much, Tom. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I'm looking out at this growing field of Republican contenders for the GOP nomination, maybe for the White House. Karen Tumulty, begin to take us in here. We got Rand Paul yesterday, and he's saying we've got to take our country back. How are Republicans feeling about the lineup that's emerging, Karen? We'll ask David and Steve, but what do you see?
Well, I think Republicans are feeling pretty good about the lineup, especially when you compare it to the 2012 lineup. I mean, you've got a good selection of governors and sitting senators, and I think a lot fewer of sort of the kind of novelty candidates that we saw in 2012, the people who would sort of, you know, one – it was almost like whack-a-mole for Mitt Romney, one after the other. They'd, you know, somebody, a Michelle Bachmann or a Herman Cain or somebody would get their debate moment.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, I think this is overall a very credible field, although, you know, I'm still trying to figure this out myself. In fact, shortly after we get off the air today, I'm headed for the airport to Iowa to see an event that Steve is going to moderate tomorrow to figure out where social conservatives are headed in Iowa.
Yesterday it was Rand Paul. He, of course, the big libertarian. And here was his opening message out of Louisville.
I have a message. A message that is loud and clear and does not mince words. We've come to take our country back.
David Winston in Washington. When Rand Paul says we've come to take our country back, what does he mean, sir?
Well, obviously, what he's trying to reflect is that there is dissatisfaction in the country, at least in terms of how President Obama has performed. And when you take a look at the polls, you can see that in terms of his job approval, the president's job approval, that sort of reflects the situation. However, the challenge is more than just simply asserting a statement. And I think this is going to be the challenge of the Republican field. What's the compelling idea that builds that majority coalition that takes advantage of that opportunity? And that's where you're looking at these group of candidates. And I would agree, as a Republican, I would agree with Karen's assessment that in looking at this particular field, there's a much more positive view, but still the challenge to this field is defining that compelling idea that galvanizes and creates a majority coalition.
Steve, what do you see in the 2016 lineup as it's beginning to emerge, watching there from Iowa, compared to 2012? How does this look, Steve?
Well, I think that the energy level within the grassroots, Tom, is very similar on the Republican side to what it was for Democrats after they had a big midterm election victory in 2006. And, the liberal grassroots went into the next presidential primary, and the establishment in the Democratic Party had already chosen sort of Hillary as their proxy. And Barack Obama ran an outsider campaign that was born here in my home state of Iowa. He literally invented a new methodology of campaigning, the use of social media, micro-targeting donors to find people that maybe aren't traditionally a part of the process but like your ideas and that you can mobilize and galvanize. And he brought new people into the process, organized them, and even with a strong third contender in John Edwards, he ended up beating Hillary Clinton here, and that launched him to the presidency. And I see the Republican grassroots is similarly motivated after the big midterm election victory last year, that the Republican grassroots has really lost a lot of favor and faith in the Republican establishment. And what is the biggest difference in this cycle than the last several, Tom, is that you have conservative leaders and mobilizers that are already meeting, already discussing. They are bound and determined. We're not going to splinter our votes five or six different ways and allow the establishment candidate to win. By the end of this year, at the latest, we want to see if we can coalesce behind one candidate. So I think it is an environment that is going, if that's the key, then I think you have to be a broad spectrum conservative to appeal to both the Americans for Prosperity and the American Family Association crowd.
But how do they do that in Iowa if it's the real conservatives who want to coalesce around one candidate here? Of course, you had winners in those caucuses in recent times out here. We had Santorum, we had Huckabee, went nowhere.
Well, you have to understand the role of Iowa. The role of Iowa is the paring down of the process. The Republican Party has never nominated somebody that did not finish in the top three in Iowa. Never. And if you look at the history of the Republican Party, every time someone wins two of the first three early states, Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina, they're always the nominee, and Republicans have never nominated somebody that didn't do that. So although Santorum was the technical winner in Iowa 4 years ago, your guests and your audience should recall that it was actually a couple of weeks after the Iowa caucuses that vote was recertified. On caucus night, Mitt Romney was declared the winner, and he rode that momentum into New Hampshire, won two of the first three early states, and was the nominee. So the key is that really Iowa's the place where that coalescing has to take place. And also, if you win the Iowa caucuses, traditionally you finish no lower than second in South Carolina because the demographics of those two states are very similar. It is New Hampshire that is the outlier. New Hampshire likes to brag it's a libertarian state, but it almost always goes to the Republican establishment anointed candidate. So I'm pretty much, as a grassroots guy, I'm just chalking that went into Jeb's corner right now.
Karen, the conventional wisdom has become that it's difficult for the GOP in a national election to win. What about this time? If it's Hillary Clinton, and so far you'd have to say that looks like the high likelihood, what about the basic math here of the GOP looking out on 2016, Karen?
Well, they've got to win back some states that Barack Obama won once or twice. And so I think that on the one hand, you do have this high energy that Steve is talking about in the grassroots, but you also have a very high desire to win. So, the party has to be looking not only to somebody who can carry its ideas forward, but basically to, somebody who can win Virginia, somebody, who has enough crossover appeal in November, because this is a party that has only won the popular vote, once since, since the 90s. So again, there's also this very, very high desire to win in a country that is changing demographically and politically.
David Winston, this seems to be the Jeb Bush calculation, that do it however you want, but at the end of the day, it comes back to him because he's that more moderate guy who can win in the general election. If you really want to win, come to him. He's out in Colorado yesterday while Rand Paul is announcing Jeb Bush is out, visiting a Mexican grocery and speaking Spanish and giving that big tent emanation one more time. Does the math come down to him, David?
I think there's some other people who can potentially put that same math together. But I think what he's outlining is, in fact, the challenge. How do you build a majority coalition? How do you get 50% or more of the vote? And I think that what he's laying out is here's his way of doing it, and here is a set of ideas. I think there are a variety of candidates, and that's why I think this field is particularly strong, where you can see that occurring. Again, you're looking at somebody like a Scott Walker, who's won a state that President Obama carried. You've got Jeb Bush coming out of Florida. You potentially have John Kasich. So you have a variety of in Ohio. You have a variety of people who know how to put together that majority coalition. So I think you'll see a variety of candidates making that point. The question is who makes the best argument and who can do that in a way that sort of appeals to the somewhat conservatives within the Republican Party and build a majority coalition first within the party and then at a national level.
Steve Dace in Des Moines, is there a chance that this conservative group that wants to come together behind one name, one person here, would come together behind Jeb Bush for a win? Or is it ideology first?
No chance. Lower than zero. Negative integer chance.
So what does that mean? If they have their way, if they get their candidate and get that person nominated, can they win nationally?
Well, you guys are off, frankly, with all due respect, you're offering a false choice. I mean, Karen is correct that it can't just be someone who carries your ideas forward. It has to be somebody who can win Virginia. But the way Republicans win Virginia is with someone who can carry their ideas forward. That is the key. Whenever elections are about personalities, Democrats always win. Whenever they're about issues, Republicans always win. The last couple of presidential elections have been about personalities. They've not been about issues. They've been about the first black president. They've been about George W. Bush's low approval rating in 2008. In 2012, the election was about Romney and 47%, and how many car elevators does he have, and the fact he can't even remember everywhere he owns a home.
Yep.
I mean, so if the election is about issues, the Republicans win. The reason they won the midterms in 2010 and 2014 is because those elections were about issues. The Republicans need to nominate a candidate that can actually credibly stand for their issues and use a national platform to change hearts and minds. They haven't done that the last few times, and that's why they have not won. And I'm just going to tell you this, Tom. Jeb Bush is never going to be president. Never. He's never going to turn out your base. He's never going to be president. It's the same argument we have with Romney, McCain, Dole, et cetera. The guys you guys all tell us can win never do, except this time it's even worse because his last name is Bush. So it's everything that nobody wanted about McCain, Dole, and Romney, plus a last name that right now is mud for a lot of conservatives and a lot of just general election voters. So even if the Republicans nominated him, all you're doing is telling Hillary, you've got a six-month start to start measuring the drapes in the White House. He's never going to win for same reasons all those other guys did.
I hear it, and I'm not telling anybody who needs to be nominated here. I'm really interested who will come out of this. Do you see the big compelling idea that will take the winner to a victory?
Well, I think the one thing that one of our panelists said I completely agree with is it does have to be a big, compelling idea. Taking our country back, I mean, that's a rallying cry. What does that mean? If I can't meet my payroll in my small business, if I've got more money, if I've got more month in the money than money in the month, when I'm trying to figure out how to send my kids to college, how to pay the mortgage this month, what does that actually mean? And what Republicans need to do is nominate a candidate who says, it's not about you didn't build that. It's not about you did build that. That was the mistake Romney made. The argument needs to be you can build that. That the American dream is one day you might go from the guy that signs the back of the check to signing the front.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the GOP and 2016, looking at the emerging lineup of Republican contenders for the White House, strengths, weaknesses, where they could take the party, the country. Steve Dace is with us. His Steve Dace Show is on across the country, based out of Iowa, author of Rules for Patriots, How Conservatives Can Win Again. David Winston is here from the Winston Group, planning, polling, strategy, work with a lot of Republicans there. Karen Tumulty is with us, national political correspondent for the Washington Post. Here was Rand Paul again in Kentucky saying, here I come, let's take it back, balance the budget, his big message.
We the people must rise up and demand action. Congress will never balance the budget unless you force them to do so. Congress has an abysmal record with balancing anything.
Rand Paul, and he goes after Democrats and Republicans on that front. Republicans firing back already within 24 hours of him running. One of these big secret money groups ran a TV ad calling Rand Paul wrong and dangerous on Iran. Here it is.
Rand Paul is wrong and dangerous. Tell him to stop siding with Obama, because even one Iranian bomb would be a disaster.
David Winston, strengths and weaknesses for the latest announcee, Rand Paul. How do you see him, David?
Well, first off, I mean, he clearly represents a specific constituency within the party. So therefore, he starts with a base from which to work.
Libertarians, his dad's posse, kind of.
Yeah, and it's a clear, sizable group. The problem that his father had was he was never actually able to grow that group, and that's the challenge in terms of how do you take what you're talking about and make that appeal a more broader-based appeal. Clearly, in what he was trying to do yesterday, he was sort of mitigating some of how he was approaching Iran in terms of statements he had made earlier. And you heard within his announcement – focusing on some other items to sort of try to broaden that base. That's his challenge.
I mean, he doesn't want to go to war. He has supported negotiating with Iran. He's been generally supportive of a deal with Iran. He doesn't want U.S. military interventionism generally has been his strong message over time.
But then he also took the position of strongly supporting the Corker bill in terms of making sure the Senate had a role in terms of whatever deal was made and trying to sort of play a larger role in terms of foreign affairs without trying to sort of contradict what he had said earlier. I mean, that's going to be very difficult, look, within the Republican Party in terms of being able to push that position. Clearly, from what you heard in terms of that spot that you just played in terms of attacking back and that issue, that's going to be a challenge for him. Having said that, again, his big challenge, like many of these candidates, is they start with a group of people initially that is a core element within the party. In other words, it's a clearly specifically identified group. How do you grow that to a majority coalition within the Republican Party, let alone the country as a whole?
Karen, who's gunning for Rand Paul in that ad? He's wrong and dangerous on Iran. This is secret money, big money foundation for a secure and prosperous America, but we don't know whose money that is. You can interpret for us, I imagine.
Right. Yeah. Get used to it, not knowing who these ads are coming from there because of, you know, I mean, this is how politics is going to be played. I mean, it could come from the sort of conventional national security forces within the party. It could come from, you know, allies of Israel. Sheldon Adelson
dumping his money in right there already, or who knows?
It could very well be. And, you know, I think Rand Paul's real problem here is that the world has changed around him. Coming out of the 2012 election and maybe even going as far back as the 2008 election, there did appear to be, even on the part of Republicans, a degree of war weariness, a degree of, you know, eagerness to shake the George W. Bush brand of interventionist foreign policy. But what has happened in the last year to year and a half is the rise of ISIS and these horrific beheading videos. And all of a sudden, the world looks like a much more dangerous place than it is. So as Rand Paul adjusts, you know, you could call it political calculation, but you can also say, look, this is a guy who understands the world looks a lot different than it did to a lot of Americans.
I mean, adjusting, but not dropping, for example, on federal surveillance of American citizens. Here he was again yesterday saying, no, it's none of their damn business. Big line for him.
Warrantless searches of America's phones and computer records are un-American and a threat to our civil liberties. I say that your phone records are yours. I say the phone records of law-abiding citizens are none of their damn business.
Steve Deleese in Des Moines, what about Rand Paul? You say Jeb Bush never. What about your libertarian in the lineup?
Well, I think when you talk to grassroots conservatives, I think Karen is correct. I think that there is a lot of war weariness. People are really tired, Tom, of being the urban renewal program for the Middle East, and they just don't think that it works. So I don't think it's really Rand Paul's foreign policy broadly that is the problem. Most Americans, most conservatives, for example, agreed with him 2 years ago that intervening in Syria to help al-Qaeda topple Assad was a mistake. The problem he's going to have with foreign policy is whether or not he truly is pro-Israel. And that is an issue that, you know, I've been very involved in the last few Republican presidential cycles. That issue right now is more on the front burner than it has been in the last few. And, you know, he's given very conflicting statements about that. He's filed legislation to end foreign aid to Israel. On the other hand, though, he's taken groups of Christian conservatives to Israel and met with the Israeli Likud party government. So I think that's what he's going to really have to flesh out, whether he's truly pro-Israel or not. And frankly, there are a lot of libertarians that are not pro-Israel.
Well, let me ask you about the rank and file in Iowa. Is the pro-Israel requirement now, is that a Sheldon Adelson, big money, you know, Jewish contributor issue, or is it a rank and file issue in Iowa? Is it both?
You know, Iowa's Liberty class is a lot different than what you see in Nevada or Maine in New Hampshire. It's not, you know, 25-year-old or the Facebook generation, as Rand calls it. A lot of them are homeschoolers, and Karen will see a lot of them on Thursday when she comes here. A lot of them are Christian conservatives who went to Ron Paul and the Liberty Movement because they didn't think guys like Huckabee or Santorum were really strong on limiting government. But they're very pro-Israel. And so I think, you know, trying to maintain his libertarian base in Iowa is a tougher challenge for Rand than anywhere else, and it's why you've seen Ted Cruz make major inroads there already.
Here we've got a listener online saying a GOP group attacks Rand Paul on day one. What happened to Reagan's 11th commandment? What do you say, Steve? Don't attack a fellow Republican.
You know, it's funny. I wonder if I've often wondered if Jerry Ford thought in the summer of 76, man, where's that whole 11th commandment thing? Right, Ronald Reagan,
hey, Ronnie.
State by state.
Yeah.
I bet Jerry Ford wished they had that 11th commandment back then. I mean, it's called a vetting process. That's
right.
What we do.
Carve that one in stone. Rob in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Rob, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I have a quick comment and then a question for you or your panel. My takeaway from the announcement with Rand Paul yesterday was that he's almost trying to be too much of a centrist and towing the line and trying to appeal to everybody. And one of your panelists just mentioned that Republicans are already going after him. I'm wondering, how long do you think it will be before Rand changes some of his opinions that he announced yesterday just to keep his conservative base?
David Winston, what do you say? I mean, a centrist, Rob says. On the other hand, he's a huge budget cutter. He would go much, much, much more deeply into the federal budget than Paul Ryan or other Republicans have proposed. Are there steps that Rand Paul can take that would fit in his cosmos that would make him more palatable, more widely in the GOP, or does he have to stay in his corner or lose his base?
Well, I, of all the words, I probably would not associate with him as centrist. I mean, I think one of the things that Rand Paul brings to this race is that he's not he's someone who's difficult to classify.
Yeah.
And again, you've got, you know, interesting views in terms of foreign policy.
Doesn't want the drug war, doesn't want the NSA surveillance.
Right. And then you've got him being very a strict fiscal conservative. And so, I mean, I think he's a difficult person to attach a label, which is, again, something within the Republican Party. How do you then get to a point where you're getting 50% of the party? I think his challenge to getting there is quite different than some of the other candidates who are sort of approaching it from the point of view of, I'm starting here as a hard conservative. How do I grow and pull in the somewhat conservative and that dynamic? So I would say centrist is not an appropriate word for him.
Here's a guy who doesn't call himself a centrist, not that Rand Paul would either, but Ted Cruz, the first one out of the gates, formally talking at Liberty University. This was last month, his 2016 announcement.
God's blessing has been on America from the very beginning of this nation. And I believe God isn't done with America yet.
And Ted Cruz may be just getting started. Karen, how do you see this candidacy? Ted Cruz, strengths and weaknesses.
Well, he's obviously making a big, big play for the social conservative, the evangelical base. It was very unusual to see a guy. He went to Liberty University, a very large religious school in Virginia. It's not his alma mater. As we know, he's an Ivy League product. He did not go to his home in Texas. He went straight for the social conservative base. That's pretty clear what his strategy is going to be. There was a real contrast, I thought, and I would love to hear from Steve and Dave on both of these, that I really thought that his speech was very thematic and very fuzzy as compared to Rand Paul yesterday, who actually had a lot of specific ideas in his speech. And also, I felt, at least just listening to him from afar, a lot more energy.
Steve, how about it? Ted Cruz, energy and overall strengths, weaknesses, capacity here.
Well, if you look at Rand's speech yesterday, it seemed as if he almost pandered to everybody except conservatives. There was no mention of amnesty, no mention of Obamacare, no mention of religious freedom, no mention of the pro-life issue. And if you look at the speech that Ted gave, it was clear that he believes, Cruz does, that his path is through those same conservatives. And really, you know, the process is a lot like the NCAA basketball tournament we just had. And if you start out thinking, let's see how we match up against potential teams in the Final Four, you don't get there. You get upset early on. Pardon me. You've got to actually win your early bracket. And the early bracket right now for these candidates is Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina. It doesn't really matter what anybody living in Montana Montana or Idaho or Washington State or California or New York, think of these candidates, they're not voting before March 1st. So, excuse me, it's really about those three states. And I'll tell you this, Tom, Ted Cruz came here last week. I've never seen as big a crowds and more energy for a candidate this early in the process. And I was reading this morning, Bloomberg is reporting his super PACs have already raised $31 million. The campaign itself has raised $4 million off of 95% $100 or less donations in the first couple of weeks. Those are, frankly, Obama 08 kind of grassroots fundraising numbers. Those are astonishing, really.
Dave Winston, Ted Cruz, he's got that kind of money enthusiasm behind him right now. And numbers, can he pull that, carry that forward as a social conservative? Is that the path in 2016?
Well, again, part of the challenge that he was having, and as Karen was alluding to this thematic piece, I mean, what he's got to show is some ability to translate that to real outcomes. Can he actually make stuff happen? And so far, his record has been not particularly good in that. I mean, I think that everybody would sort of associate him at this point with the shutting down of government in terms of that happened a year and a half ago, that we went into a situation and then we got to the point he wanted to be at, and then all of a sudden there was no solution. So I think he's facing that challenge. But I want to suggest a larger dynamic here, and I think this particular conversation reflects the challenge the Republican Party has faced. We're some, you know, half hour into this discussion, and we haven't really talked about, so how are Republicans going to address the number one issue in the country, and that's jobs and the economy? And that's really that, and this is about issues and not personalities. I agree with Stephen that that was a fundamental error that was made both in 2008 and 12. So the question is, okay, what Republican is going to come up with that compelling idea? And what's that Republican dynamic that can sustain that conversation? Because when it gets off into these other issues, the public is interested, but it's not what's driving them. And that's the real challenge here for the Republican field, is how to keep focused on the issues that really matter.
You've got people who are talking about that. We had Scott Walker, Wisconsin governor in New Hampshire, talking with the GOP there in March, talking about the economy.
The rest of us who live in reality understand we grow the economy in cities and towns and villages all across this great country, that people create jobs, not the government. And it's about time we have leaders that want to help the people of this country grow the economy.
Karen, the economy, Scott Walker, anybody else who sounds credible there? Scott Walker in Wisconsin, he's had a controversial track record of changing state law there. He says opening things up for more growth. Is that a winning idea nationally in 2016?
Well, this is why governors, especially in Republican primaries, tend to have a real advantage, because they have actually been out in the world and done things. And as Washington becomes more and more paralyzed, it's really hard for any senator to point to an actual accomplishment. But I do think that, you know, one place where the Republicans have sort of missed the mark is that, you know, their messaging in the last few cycles, it's been as though, you know, everyone is an entrepreneur. When in fact, if you look at the public's anxiety about the economy, it's more the fact that, you know, you look at your kids and you don't see them getting a good job coming out of college. And it's hard to imagine how they will ever be able to buy a house and get out from under their college debt. And people are just worried that their kids are not having the same kind of opportunities that they had. And again, I think treating every economic issue as though, you know, everyone's an entrepreneur doesn't really get to what is and remains, I think, the basic anxiety on the part of most Americans.
There's some of that in Scott Walker, certainly. Many references to Ronald Reagan, kind of a like to get back to that morning in America idea. Here he was in February talking Reagan.
As someone who came of age when Ronald Reagan was the president, I was inspired with his leadership then. It called people like me, not just so much to be a Republican or conservative, it called people like me to pursue a life of public service.
Steve Dace, throw off the shackles of government, go out there and be entrepreneurs, go out there and be winners. Is that a winning message nationally, or does it scare Americans who have seen a lot of people hurt by an economy that just tumbled down badly?
Well, again, I think we're getting ahead of ourselves. I mean, I think, you know, I hate to sound like Bill Belichick here, but I mean, it's one game at a time, guys. I mean, you actually have to win the game ahead of you right now. The game ahead of you is not what a middle-class family in suburban Chicago thinks. That is not the game ahead of you right now. The game ahead of you right now is, what do voters in Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina think? Because if you're not in the top three in Iowa, you're done the next day. If you don't win two of those first three early states, you're not going to win the nomination. So it's really about what those people on the ground think. What are the issues that drive them to the polls?
They like Reagan. Do you see a new Reagan in Scott Walker?
I think Scott Walker has so far done a very poor job of articulating on any issue other than I busted unions in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And so I think when you get into those primary voters and activists in those three early states, particularly Iowa and South Carolina, they're going to ask existential issues. They want to know, what kind of country are we going to raise our children in? What kind of culture? Am I going to be free to believe what I want to believe? Or am I going to be targeted to have my local business shut down like what happened in Indiana last week? I mean, those are the questions that the people that are going to be voting in the Iowa and South Carolina primaries and caucuses, those are the questions they're going to have to answer, those candidates. And the argument that you guys are having is, frankly, a broader argument that really doesn't play into the process until much later on, when the rest of the general public has a say. Right now, you've got to win your early bracket, and that early bracket is Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at the GOP in 2016, looking at the emerging lineup of contenders there. Rand Paul making his announcement formally yesterday. Ted Cruz already in, and a lot more coming, and probably pretty darn soon. You can join us this hour. Do you have a favorite here? Who? Why? Make the case. Are you going with ideology or electability? Can the GOP win the White House in 2016? What would that take? And what would you want or expect from a Republican presidency now? What's it going to take in the early brackets, as my guest Steve Day says? With the Steve Day Show out of Des Moines, Iowa, David Winston here from the Winston Group joins us from Washington today. Karen Tumulty with the Washington Post, national political correspondent there. Let's go to our listeners. Tom in Sioux City, Iowa. Tom, you're on the air. What do you see?
Well, I just wanted to comment on Senator Cruz. He's got a lot of grassroots support. And these guys do not suffer dissension well. 3 weeks ago, I was invited to a Republican focus group by a Des Moines-centered public relations firm or marketing firm. It was held in Sioux City. There was about 10 of us in the room. And at one point, we were talking about electability of candidates. And I just said that I think Senator Cruz is just way too meat cleaver. He's going to take a meat cleaver to all the social programs, do away with Medicare, Obamacare, I mean, everything. And I ended my comment by saying that I think if Cruz becomes the nominee of the party, I'm going to leave the party. And then we got that. At that point, the moderator said, well, let's take a short break. And then about 10 seconds after that, the guy that's running the program came in and tapped me on the shoulder and said, can you follow me out into the hall for a second, but bring your stuff with you?
Uh-oh. Booted.
Threw me out. And so what they want to do is they just want to preach the gospel. I mean, talk about a revivalist.
But Tom, you hear Steve Dace, who's from your neck of the woods here, saying this is what it's going to take in Iowa. If you want to get past that conservative block there, this is the perspective you've got to satisfy. Maybe you're just not in the right place, Tom, to drive that home.
My point is that gentleman is very accurate, and it just proves that Iowa has no right being a kingmaker. That's my point, is you're letting a bunch of people they don't even care if the people in the focus group I was with don't even care if the president's got a college education. Now, my God, the guy's got he's running a $15 trillion economy and a huge budget. And they don't even care if he has a college education?
Tom, we've got it. Dave Winston, is Iowa a problem? In just the way that Steve Dace describes and maybe embraces, but our caller Tom says there's a problem here.
Well, no, I mean, first off, you have to recognize the sort of what Iowa brings to the table in terms of impacting the process. First off, Iowa is actually one of the more conservative states in terms of the electorate and in terms of what a caucus or electorate looks like. Almost half the folks in terms of the exit polls or actually the entrance polls last time identified themselves as very conservative. The thing about the Republican primary process is the center of gravity isn't with very conservative. It's the somewhat conservative. Basically, the party is divided into thirds. You have a very conservative group, somewhat conservative, and then the sort of moderate liberal group all represent about a third. It's the somewhat conservative that basically defines the outcome. And so what happens is you start with an initial state that takes it to just specifically one group, the very conservative. But I want to go back to one other point that Steve was saying, that you need that you don't want to get to these themes that appeal to middle class that early. And I would argue, having done this with Newt in South Carolina in 2012 when he won South Carolina, in fact, the decision was made that he was going to walk into that first debate and really talk about how he was going to address the economic concerns and problems of South Carolinians. And he came back from being behind by double digits to actually win that primary by a wide margin. In fact, what these candidates need to do is get to that big idea. What's their compelling reason? That's how they're going to succeed. And I think we've got a variety of candidates who, in fact, can get to those big ideas.
If they can get through that bracket, at least in the top three, Steve says. Katie in Buffalo, New York. Katie, you're on the air. What do you think?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is for Steve. I know that we need to look at Iowa, South Carolina, and New Hampshire, but don't we also need to look down the road a little bit as well to find a candidate that's both appealing to those local voters, those first three voters, and then also more broadly toward the general election?
I mean, that's where it ends up, Steve, and we've seen it before. I know you've got the bracket, but there's a bigger field beyond it. Steve Dace, are you there? Oh, it looks like we dropped Steve right there. Karen, this is the old Republican conundrum or opportunity, depending on how you look at it.
Well, now here's the other issue that we really haven't talked a lot about that I think I honestly don't know the answer to this, but may sort of spoil the old bracket system. And that is the big money players. The only reason that Newt Gingrich was still on that stage in South Carolina was that he had a major funder in the form of Sheldon Adelson. And so all of these candidates this time around are looking for that guy who will write the 7 or 8 figure check or 9 figure check to sort of keep them going. Pat, and I don't know what this does to the early dynamic where, you know, Iowa goes one way, New Hampshire goes another, South Carolina breaks the tie. But now we do have these big money players who could give a candidate a lifeline to get into the later brackets.
Even if they don't clear that Iowa hurdle, you're saying, that top three must have that Steve Dace describes?
Well, we certainly saw Newt Gingrich last time going into Florida because, you know, again, only primarily on the strength of a funder. And he won South Carolina, where I think in the earlier system, he wouldn't have probably still even been in the race at that point.
When the billionaires weigh in, maybe anything can happen. Michael in Montgomery, Alabama. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. There's 4 points that I have here. Most Americans don't understand that Bush Sr. and Bush Jr., they started dismantling Reagan as soon as they got in August in the progressive mold. And McCain is not a Republican. He co-sponsored with liberal Democrats 5 of the most liberal Democrats' bills that were not showed that he's not a Republican. Who I would throw my vote for is the governor of Ohio. And Scott Walker would be a far, far second from that. And Rubio, I'd like to see him as a vice president. You've got to embrace the Spanish vote to win this election.
Why John Kasich out of Ohio, Michael? Why Kasich?
I think he represents more of America than anybody else I've seen, based on what he said. And that's why. But the other variable, the big variable is Hillary willing to stand equal, other than behind her gender, with the help of her media?
Is willing
That's
to stand equal.
Point.
I mean, everybody runs on what they've got. Yeah, she's a woman, and everybody uses what they've got, but I assume that she's going to come up and make her case. Well, Michael, we've got it. And let me pick that up, David Winston. What about entrants that aren't on the short list of those people expect to get into this race? Maybe John Kasich among them.
Yeah, I mean, the two big names that are still out there are Governor Pence of Indiana and Governor Kasich of Ohio. John Kasich has got a really interesting potential argument to make, given the economic success of the state. I mean, he came in, there was a huge deficit, it's running a surplus, unemployment has dropped dramatically. And he's got one of the few arguments that a lot of folks don't have, and that is, and he's clearly made this, and that is he's actually the only one who was there in the late 90s when the economy took off and the budget was actually balanced when he was chair of the budget committee. So we've got some people, both Pence and Kasich being example, who have not necessarily made it their intentions known, that could dramatically change the nature of what this race looks like on the Republican side.
Let's hear from Marco Rubio. He was at a Politics and Eggs breakfast. This is in February. Florida, of course, senator there, saying the education system we've got in this country, inadequate for the skilled jobs of the future for the economy. Rubio.
We can create better paying jobs, but those jobs will require more education than ever. The problem we have is we have a one-size-fits-all higher education system, which is basically this. You either get a four-year degree or you get nothing. That is no longer acceptable and is no longer responsive.
Marco Rubio. Steve Dace, our Alabama caller, wants Marco Rubio as a VP on a ticket. What about Rubio?
You know, I think he is the most fascinating candidate in this race, Tom. And the reason why is because he might be the most overall gifted. I don't know that he's quite as intellectually, prodigious as Cruz, but he's certainly very smart. And you've talked to him about issues at length. He can go in depth. He's very eloquent, very likable. In fact, I would say that if he had not made himself the poster child of the Gang of Eight, that
this was with immigration reform, and he got on board with that, and it cost him in some quarters.
When he became really the human shield for the McCain-Schumer amnesty scam, when he did that, I mean, that really undercut a lot of his energy heading into this process. And he's going to have to show the conservatives that he's gifted enough on a vast array of other issues that they will overlook that. But I think he's a dangerous potential candidate because if the establishment decides, listen, we can try and go down the road of Jeb Bush and shove this guy down the conservatives' throats, and, you know, we'll be arguing with our own base on Halloween whether to vote Republican again. Or they can decide, you know what, why don't we go with somebody that actually might appeal to our base so we're not fighting a civil war after Labor Day. And if they decide that candidate is who they should go for, I would think Rubio would be at very top of that list.
Civil war after Labor Day. Here was Jeb Bush. This is back all the way back in 2013, talking with the Conservative Political Action get together in Washington, CPAC, but with the message that was resonant then about Republicans needing to be a bigger tent, more open.
Way too many people believe Republicans are anti-immigrant, anti-woman, anti-science, anti-gay, anti-worker, and the list goes on and on and on. Many voters are simply unwilling to choose our candidates, even though they share our core beliefs, because those voters feel unloved, unwanted, and unwelcome in our party.
Karen Tumulty, is Jeb Bush still talking about the Republicans as anti-immigrant, anti-woman, anti-science, anti-gay, anti-worker?
Well, I thought, he appeared again this year at CPAC, and he was maybe not in that tone, but sounding many of those exact same themes. And, Jeb Bush has said basically he believes it is possible to win the election by losing the primary, that he could, if he can squeak out the nomination somehow without changing what he believes, that it makes him a stronger candidate for the general. We'll see. But it's he also has said, that he doesn't see a point in running if he can't do it with joy and do it on what he believes. And so far, we have not seen him backing away or going through, some of the transformations we've seen in some of the other candidates.
David Winston, Steve Day says, Jeb Bush, never, not going to happen. Clearly, that's not the way he's looking at it. There's been a fair amount of money lining up with him. There is that name, for better or worse. How do you see his candidacy ultimately, David?
Well, I mean, certainly at this point, he is clearly competitive. I mean, when you take a look at a lot of the national surveys, and even when you look at a lot of the state surveys, he is clearly in a position where he has a group of supporters behind him. His challenge, and you can define the name or where he positions himself politically, he's got to figure out how does he get to 50%. And having said that, lining up the resources he has, is something that will help in terms of infrastructure. But ultimately, like I'm going to suggest, he has the same challenge that all the other candidates have. Okay, they've got interesting stories. They've got interesting starting points. But who's got the compelling idea that's going to overcome the other people's support and be able to begin that majority coalition? I want to go back to one other point that Karen made, because I think this is really important in terms of the role of money. And again, I want to go back to South Carolina. Sheldon Adelson was funding the Super PAC. The Super PAC was pushing Bain ads, which, in fact, was not helpful to Newt at that point. And one of the problems with all this big money is that it's not the campaigns. It's some other entity trying to anticipate maybe with the campaign. But actually what they do is they create this culture of attacking opponents. Mm-hmm. And the problem for candidates when you're trying to drive ideas is when all the money is going to how do you attack folks, it's very hard to get your idea to break through that. And I actually think what happens with all this money is it actually diminishes candidate voice. And that's a problem on the Republican side if we're trying to focus on issues and not personalities, and that's how the money's being used in terms of a negative way. It diminishes the ideas our candidates have.
But it's in there already, isn't it? It's inevitable. And of course, the Hillary Clinton, they're talking about a $1 billion campaign there as well.
It may be, but I'm still telling you, at least in terms of being able to support candidates and their ideas, right now the big money is not going to do that in the process of not doing that, and it's going to attacking candidates. And I'm just telling you, on the Republican side last time, it was particularly destructive. And by the time that primary was over, left the Republican candidate, Romney in this case, in a terrible position.
Karen, in Youngstown, Ohio. Karen, you're on the air. What do you think?
I just want to say that I think Kasich has been a terrible governor. He's anti-worker. He's anti-labor. He wants to privatize everything. He represents the worst of the far right, the radical right that got our country into the situation that it was in 2008. So I just would like people to do their research and not listen to sound bites that promote him as a great governor. Talk to people who live here. He's not a good governor.
There's the word from Youngstown, Ohio. One word anyway. Steve Dace, how does a Republican candidate stay out of the Mitt Romney trap? You know, the famous videotape where he's talking down on about half of the country. Mm-hmm. You know, people who don't necessarily bite on the go out and start your own company message. Or is there something else that's going to be at the heart of that economic message?
Well, I think, you know, if you have a compelling life story of overcoming adversity, having lived a life very similar to a lot of the American people, I think that certainly helps you resonate with them. If you go back to the clip you played of Jeb Bush, Tom, everything he said there is just a total fabrication. I mean, frankly, it's a steaming pile. It might be what people who will never vote for us, like the last caller you just had from Youngstown, Ohio, think. But if I'm correct here, Tom, I think we just had an election last November, and right now nationwide there are fewer Democrats in the legislative branch in all 50 states than we've had in 86 years. Okay, so I mean that argument just isn't true. What kills us is what you just said, Tom. What kills us is when we want to win a key swing state like Ohio, and we tell them, well, if Obama bails out the auto industry in Toledo, Ohio, that's big government socialism. And then the same exact Republican nominee says, however, if we don't bail out Merrill Lynch, the entire government will shut down, and cats and dogs will sleep together, and it will rain sideways. You cannot win the argument that we're not going to help the guy work in the assembly line, but we're going to help the people in the boardroom on Wall Street. And that those sorts of candidates, and that's what Jeb Bush is, that's what Romney was, that's what McCain was, that's what Dole was, that's why those candidates can't win. They can't win middle class voters in a general election, not to mention the fact that they can't turn out their own base. And wait, Tom, we just had an election where Obama won re-election despite losing independence nationwide.
Steve, we've got it. The clock is on us. Steve Dace with the show out of Des Moines. Thank you, Karen Tumbley, who's headed for Iowa. Good luck there, Karen, with the Washington Post. David Winston, always great to have you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.